This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. As ever, I'm here with that chap called Alan. How you doing, Alan?
Hello, I'm great, Parv. I'm excited to be on the show today, especially with who else we've got on.
Yes, we have a very special guest, the chairman himself, JT Rosero. How you doing, Justin?
Oh, hello, gentlemen. It feels good to get out of that stuffy event center and actually get to join the lads right here in the booth. I'm very excited. Thanks for having me for a full show. I've been dying to be on.
Now, is it JT or is it Justin? Is that like some Shawnee thing?
JT's here today. I'm not sure what Justin's up to.
Okay.
He's going to get you those paychecks, Alan, so don't worry about it.
Oh, that's all right. Well, I'm pleased, yeah. And also a Christmas present as well, please.
Of course. I'll let him know. I'll make sure he sends you over a nice dirty F tie or something like that.
But what about those digs you've been sending me, like calling Alan and the Nikolai Volkov of Place to Be and all of that?
I don't really answer to the transgressions of Justin. I mean, I'm JT, so whatever he's been doing, I don't know. I don't really, you know, I'm halfway across the country from him, so I don't know what to tell you.
All right, well, let's not waste any further time and get straight into that bulging sack, Alan.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Okay, let me just rustle the sack. And the first question is, dear Alan and Parv, and JT, what are your thoughts on Royal Rumble 94? And that's from Bradley DiMatteo in Bensalem, Pennsylvania. So, Royal Rumble 94, I enjoyed this show. I don't know about you two guys. One bit of trivia before we kind of get into the meat of the question is, personal favourite of yours, Parv, Ted DiBiase, he's the only colour man to have done a pay-per-view with both Vince McMahon and Eric Bischoff. So it was this show and sold out in 1997, respectively. So that's quite interesting that Ted DiBiase is the only guy to have done that with the two main power players in 90s American wrestling.
Well, I can tell you one thing for free. Royal Rumble 94 is a lot better than sold out 97.
So there yes.
Now, JT, you've got some personal history with this event, is that right?
Yeah, it's interesting that, Bradley happened to target this question the week I was going to be on because, guys, I was there live. It was the first pay-per-view I ever attended in Providence, Rhode Island. So I know it very, very well. I've seen it many, many times. And I'm actually with Scott Criscolo and myself right now are reviewing all the Raws from 93 and we're into early 94. So I'm actually rewatching the build to the show. So I am ready to go. Very well versed in the 1994 Royal Rumble.
Well, you've got some interesting takes then. You're going to have them on this show. So the opening match was Tatanka versus Bam Bam Bigelow. And it was supposed to be Tatanka versus Ludwig Borger originally. But old Tony had an ankle injury that ended up changing the course of the WWF, some may say. Because Ludwig was supposed to win this match and the only person who's really reported this was Scott Keith. But apparently he was going to use this as a stepping stone to a world title match in the coming weeks. And then he was going to lose it to Lex Luger at WrestleMania 10. Obviously, we know that didn't happen for a variety of reasons. But it's interesting that's what someone's take on the situation at the time was.
Yeah, I think he's walked that one back since. It sounds like it was like one of those back in the Wild West rumor days of the 90s on the internet. I think maybe it just got passed around. But, I mean, there could have been a hint of truth that Borga may, you know, get a title run or it be in a title feud. I think more likely was Luger winning the title at Mania from Yoko and then maybe feuding with Ludwig post-Mania, something like that. Maybe that's what it was going to be. Maybe he gets like a non-title win or something. But I was heartbroken at the time when Borga got pulled off this card. I remember they announced it on Mania, I think the morning of the show. So,
Scott Keith misreporting information. What's new, eh?
I know. I mean, but this match itself, I mean, it was just full of bear hugs. Tatanka does his pissed off racial stereotype comeback. Bigelow mocks him. Bigelow misses his kind of weird moonsault. You know, that wasn't a full moonsault rotation, but it was kind of one. Yeah. If you remember that he did. And Tatanka won the match with a flying body press. And I'd give this match, if we're doing star ratings, around about a star, I think. Last time I watched it. Was there any memories from being there live seeing this match, JT?
Yeah, I mean, It did its job in getting the crowd going, so there was definitely a buzz in the air. I remember that. But, yeah, I mean, at the time, the work didn't feel like it mattered. Going back and watching it is very pedestrian. But I guess in a cool, you know, bit of booking, in a way, even though we didn't get the Tatanka Borga blow off, we did get some closure on Tatanka Bigelow. Because remember, they had feuded back in the summer when Bigelow cut off Tatanka's hair. And they never really had a big match. They were on opposite sides of SummerSlam. So this was kind of served as like a blow off for them. So it you know, they, at least they paid off something with this match.
Well, yeah, this is the Tatanka who, though, is not undefeated. He got beat earlier on by Ludwig Borga. So this maybe have been the rematch. Well, it would have been the rematch.
Yeah, it was definitely supposed to be him, I think, getting the win back over Borga.
Well, defeat, so, yeah.
Well, one thing I've got to ask you, Justin, is or JT, sorry, is that when I was a kid, obviously I was a huge Ted DiBiase fan, and this is something I haven't grown out of. So when I very first sat down with Royal Rumble, I was marking out hugely for Ted walking out. What was it like for the live crowd that night? When did you know he was going to be there? Was it advertised, or was it a total surprise?
It was a complete surprise. So he had been gone since SummerSlam, and there was a lot of question as to who was going to announce the show, because Jerry Lawler was off at the trial, and you know, he was gone. So was he coming back? Like, I wasn't really up on the news, so I didn't know if he'd be back for the show. And I remember just waiting and waiting, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, All About the Money music hits, and it's like, oh my god, you know. So yeah, I remember marking out big time when he came out, and stuff. A solid run as a commentator, like, you know, we know about his managerial run in 94, but as a commentator, I thought he was pretty good throughout the first half of 94 when he was doing like challenge and stuff.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was a cool moment.
Carry on, Alan. What's the next match here? We'll try to speed through it.
Yeah, the next one is the tag team match for the titles. That's the Quebecers versus Brett and Owen. And it's quite interesting, the finish to this match was a ref stoppage, if you remember, guys. They stopped the match because Brett was injured because of his leg. I think he was putting a sharpshooter on Pierre and his own knee gave way, so the ref stopped the match. It was a good match. I enjoyed it. But the kind of thing that stands out for everyone is what happened after the match. Isn't that right, JT?
Yes, because Owen Hart finally snapped. He'd been building since Survivor Series, and he was tired of being in his brother's shadow. And there's a lot of cool like starts and stops throughout December where he was challenging Brett. Brett said, under no circumstances will I ever fight my brother. And then they make up over the holidays, and Owen gets them this tag team title match with the Quebecers, and Brett's kind of just there, and Owen, you know, getting little digs in here and there that, you know, Owen's leading the way with the Hitman right behind and stuff like that. And then we almost had a false start because the Quebecers lose the tag titles to the 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty on the 1-year anniversary of Raw. So now it's looking like Owen won't get his big title match because he never held a belt and he wanted his title. And then the Quebecers win the belts back a week later in MSG. So we're back on. And then the story in this match is really cool because you have Owen is on the apron. Brett's getting worked over during a really good heat segment. And then right when Brett has an opening to make the tag, he doesn't. And he ends up, the ref ends up stopping the match because Brett's leg is so messed up he can't continue. And Owen just loses his mind because he says Brett was selfish. You know, Owen's never been a champion. And Brett cost him the match because he wouldn't tag out. And after the match, of course, Owen kicks Brett's leg out of his leg. And then Brett is wheeled off. And Owen cuts this awesome promo of his life on the Titantron. And I remember, like, it just felt so chaotic in the arena that night when Brett's on the stretcher, the officials are all around him, Owen's screaming at him, and the Quebecers are celebrating. It was a really cool atmosphere, and the match itself is fantastic as well. I love this match. I thought the heat segment of Brett was great, and I think the Quebecers, this is probably a topic for another episode, but I think they were super underrated during this run in the ring.
Yeah, the match itself, I mean, I thought it was a great match, great angle, and the match and the outcome was it made Brett, to me, a bigger babyface, and Owen a massive heel just with one kick, so to speak. So I went quite high with this match. I gave this match 4 stars. So have you got anything to add that you remember from this, Parv?
No, only that I would say that this heel run here from Owen is probably the best thing he did do in his career. He was lightning, like, from this point until, I'd say, when does 96? It blow off, like the cage match, maybe? Like I know it carries on and on as he goes, like he starts tagging with Yoko and all of that, but this initial period up until like WrestleMania, maybe even SummerSlam, I just think Owen is tremendous as the kind of hard done by younger brother. You know, he cuts some phenomenal promos.
But he's always got an element of he's got a good reason to why he's done what he's done, like JT touched on, that Brett had the opening, he could have tagged Owen. Brett didn't do that because because he's the ultimate babyface and he'll soldier on forever. But Owen's got a point there. So the best heels are always the ones that have a point that people can kind of go, I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah, and it's given even more depth, as we discussed, Alan, by the very reasonable Lord Al siding with Owen during that whole deal.
So. Yeah.
And then you even have, add to the story going into SummerSlam, you have the Anvil thing at King of the Ring where he brings him back. He's in Brett's corner and they have this elaborate ruse where Anvil costs Brett or helps Brett keep the title and then turns and goes with Owen so Owen can win the belt. So there's a lot of cool tie-ins to the whole Hart family that Owen breaks out during that run. And I'd even extend it to Survivor Series when he costs Brett the title with his awesome acting outside with getting Helen to throw in the towel.
This to me is maybe this is the best kind of feud that they've had since the Longburn Savage Hogan kind of deal in 88 that played out. I don't think there's anything in between. I really enjoy this, and this is probably one of my highlights of, the 90s, if not the early 90s, at least up till 95.
Yeah, Savage Flair maybe, but this is up there. It's such a good, long, sustained run.
So the next match was for the IC title, and there are two points of interest for me here, especially the child Parv, as it were, the 8 or 9 year old, however old it was in 1994, because I would say the height of my IRS fandom was this point here.
And I think you're literally the only person who's ever said that line.
Yeah,
by the way.
I don't know. Maybe there might be someone else that might also have had him as his favorite wrestler. We don't know.
genuinely, in 1994, I was a proper Irwin R. Scheister fan, and obviously since Ted had left, he was my mate. He was now my main guy. And I remember I was in school, wrestling wasn't cool anymore, so there was only a handful of people still watching. Most people had moved on to yo-yos or Pokemon or whatever it was. What would it have been in 94? Those little Pog things, remember them, Alan?
Pogs, you put them over, those spin things and they battled each other as well.
It was something else had replaced wrestling, basically. I remember saying to those people who still watch him, watch now, he's going to be the Intercontinental Champion and you're all going to see. And I was devastated when he lost this match. One of the times where I was properly, I would say, the closest to being a full-fledged mark for a match was this one. And I really was gutted that Irwin didn't win. The other thing I've always wondered about is, for this match and this match only, DiBiase and Vince go away and they are replaced on commentary by, is it Gorilla and JR?
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, what's going on there? Any insights I was trying to explain to myself, why did this happen? Is it because Ted felt his impartiality was compromised? He didn't want to commentate on his former partner's match?
Well, I think it's more down to the fact the absolute wackiness of the booking that goes on in the next match. I think it has to be explained to everyone that's involved by Vince directly just before they go out. So he's going to be there to kind of organize that kind of circus that's going to go on in the next match. So this match itself, it was realistically there to set up WrestleMania 10 between Razor and Shawn Michaels, wasn't it? Because Shawn Michaels was involved in this match. He came out, it was a bit of chicanery from him, and the match then got restarted because he came out. And what was it that he did? Did he, I think from memory, did he
hit him with the fake belt? Yeah, he hit him with the fake belt.
So, yeah, I mean, the match itself, it went, 12, 13 minutes. Doesn't really stand out to me as a good match, really, at all. Maybe for you, Parv, it's one of your better matches because you're a big IRS fan, but I don't think it stood out to me anyway.
Yeah, it was all right. But it was actually, again, another match that had a pretty good feud behind it, because Razor had multiple feuds going on at this point. He was obviously fighting off Shawn with the fake title, and then IRS has stolen his gold back in the winter, earlier in the late fall, early winter. So this wasn't just a random IC title defense. IRS had actually been antagonizing Ramon and worked his way up to this title match, and he pissed him off by stealing his gold. And then they do the Dusty finish halfway through, like you said. So he wins. I thought, I'd never seen a live title change, so I was all pumped when IRS won. I was like, oh my God. And then they screw him over by restarting the match. They don't even let him get reset. IRS is just celebrating, and Razor just comes over and hits him with the Razor's Edge.
You have no idea what that did to me, because I was so over the moon with that at the time, and then to have it taken away as well, it was just one of those things that always stands out. Anyway, let's carry on.
One quick note on the commentary switch. So there was actually a reason behind that. At the time, they were running Radio WWF, and they had a weekly radio show in some markets. I know, I think Atlanta or a couple other markets picked it up, New York, and Jim Ross usually hosted that show. And then for a couple of pay-per-views, definitely Survivor Series and here, JR and Gorilla did live play-by-play over the radio WWF network. And I think part of that had to do with overseas, like to the armed forces and some other special markets. So they actually switched commentary roles for those two shows. If you remember back in Survivor Series, Gorilla and JR do the Heavenly Bodies Rock and Roll Express match, and Vince and Bobby go and do Radio WWF. So they do that again here. So that's where Vince and DiBiase actually went. They went to do the radio call, and we saw them live. You could see them switching booths up in the top. And then I think WrestleMania 10 had it too, but they don't switch. And I think after that, that was it.
I wonder if feeds exist for them. I'd love to listen to Ted call his former partner. Because anyway, let's carry on. What was the next match, Alan?
The next match was the WWF title match. It was a casket match between Yokozuna and The Undertaker. And just to skip to the kind of finish, it ended up being 10-on-1 against The Undertaker. So what we had Yokozuna, we had Mr. Fuji, we had Great Kabuki, who was an agent for Mr. Fuji, the same as Genichiro Tenryu. We had Bam Bam Bigelow, Adam Bomb, Jeff Jarrett, the Head Shrinkers, and Diesel for all 10 of them. And Vince, he deadpans the entire match throughout this. He sells it like it appears that the power of the urn is escaping with the Undertaker's powers. And I swear to God, he actually said this without any trace of irony at all. He played it really straight. And at the end, the video wall image of the Undertaker was quite interesting, because do either of you guys know who played the guy on who levitated up?
I do.
You do? Do you do, Parv?
No idea.
Well, it was Marty Jannetty dressed in an Undertaker costume, I believe. Am I right there, JT?
Yeah, it was. And it's funny because we could see him from our seats. We could kind of see behind the Tron, so you could see him waiting and then come up from behind it. And then we saw him walk across the catwalk after to get back down. So he didn't leave the arena and go to heaven. He walked back down the catwalk. But yeah, it was a weird, another bizarre. This day was like filled with chaos and bizarre moments. It was
I love that Vince kind of sells the whole experience as a kind of deep and meaningful spiritual experience. it was a sight to be seen, and it was an awful kind of book match, though. I mean, it didn't go down well at the time, and on rewatch from me, I think I watched this about a year ago. It was just too hokey for my tastes. I don't know. Do you have any good memories of it, Parv?
Well, for me, I think it's actually Ted DiBiase's crowning moment on commentary. he peaks on his debut.
Because mean about it.
Because he is like, he thinks he's seen, he literally cannot believe what he's seeing. And that's probably the most significant thing he ever does on commentary. Would you agree with that,
Yeah, the other thing I can think of is coming later. I'll mention it in a little bit that he's really an asshole. But here, here he's flipping out and he's really selling his ass off trying to get this thing over. And I remember the green smoke billowing out very clearly. Like, that was pretty nuts to see. And the thing that always stood out to me is what a bunch of assholes backstage that no one came out to help out. But I guess if you're looking at it from a pure, you know, what these guys were thinking, you know, would you come out when you got a big Royal Rumble match coming later tonight? You got 10 guys out there. Like, you would need an army to come out and help. So if you're just one guy, if you're like Bob Holly in the back, you know, or Sparky Plug, whatever he was at the time, you know, you're not risking your big WrestleMania title shot to come out and help The Undertaker. I mean, what's he ever done for you? So I kind of understand, but as a fan of The Undertaker, you're sitting there wondering, why is no one helping this guy?
The genius of Mr. Fuji, he's planned this. The one night you could pull this off where you're not going to get a save is the Royal Rumble, because it's every man for himself.
Devious one, definitely devious here. So the Royal Rumble itself, I'll just go through my very, very quick takeaways. First thing was Scott Steiner. I thought he had nice permed hair in this match. The match itself went to 90 minutes due to time, 90 seconds, sorry, intervals due to time constraints. We had a pretty famous sequence with Diesel, who came out as number 7. He eliminated Bart Gunn, Scott Steiner, Owen Hart, I think Quang, Bob Backlund. Yeah, it's and Billy Gunn as well, and we get the Diesel chance, and this is kind of Diesel chance as in the first kind of seeds were planted of him as a babyface here, I felt, with the fans right behind him. And I don't know if either of you two remember, but the beating he gave to poor Virgil's head with elbows was pretty brutal.
And Virgil was a poor... Virgil was replacing Kamala, so he wasn't even supposed to be there. So this poor bastard shows up, he gets this big shot, he gets his head bashed in by Diesel and chucked out. The Diesel stuff was crazy, because he had never really gotten over doing much. I mean, especially when Michaels left in the fall and he was just on his own, and like, he seemed like a man without a soul. You know, I've called this out in the reviews. He seemed very lost. He didn't know what to do. He'd reference Sean, and then they started doing the poll to bring Sean back, and he'd like be begging on behalf to bring him back. He seemed so lost without his buddy. And I mean, this is another long-time rumor that he was maybe going to be gone sooner than later because he wasn't really getting over. And that this night, with the reaction he got when he was booked to look like a monster and the crowd buying in, is kind of what bought him some more time, and then he ends up getting over. And it was a wild moment. It was pretty cool to see him get that moment, and that the fans completely got behind him as he just started destroying guys.
Yeah, the other thing that I'd like to mention on this before the kind of finish was the line from DiBiase when Tenryu came out. He basically said, he's there to do a job, he's not there to win, was DiBiase's line, which I found quite interesting looking back at that. So getting to the finish, guys, it's quite interesting. Do you buy into this whole, they use it as an experiment kind of thing that we've heard over the years between the crowd reaction with Brett and Lex?
I think there was some truth to it. You know, I think if they were really stuck on Luger, they just would have done it. So I don't know if they went into the night saying we're going to go with whoever's over more. I think they were looking for confirmation maybe that it was going to be Luger.
I'm not sure, you know, because if they were going to go with Luger, he came out at 23, and he was going. If you're a big babyface going to the Rumble, you clear all the deadwood. But the only person he actually eliminated was Kabuki. So to me, that shows that they didn't have that much faith in him. Otherwise, he'd done the whole Hogan getting rid of at least three or four people. I do understand Diesel did a similar spot earlier on the show, but to cement Luger as kind of the main man, you would have hoped that they would have done something similar.
Well, it has him as six eliminations here. He had eliminated a few people.
Oh, Bigelow. Wow. Were they just single eliminations, or did he help? I don't know.
I think your point stands. I mean, they wouldn't have put Brett into the ointment if they really wanted to have Luger get over. But the thing that burned them was that Brett was, like, beloved in Providence. Like, he always was. Him and Macho Man are the two guys that always got mega reactions in that arena. So it was kind of, once Brett was involved in that finish, and if you look at the story, they kept teasing that he wasn't going to show up, and when he limps out, the place just goes crazy. So, I mean, they kind of set up Luger to fail here with this whole way that they booked this.
Yeah, I think the whole show, it's to me, with Vince, it's, I mean, steroid trials do funny things to a man. And, you know, and I think this is evident on this show. We've got wackiness up and down the show, all sorts of stuff. Not saying it's a bad show. I mean, have you got any kind of closing thoughts, Parv, on the Royal Rumble itself, or the show in general?
Well, just on the finish, my theory's always been that you got the idea from the 92 Rumble with Sid and Hogan, the split crowd there. And I reckon that set a worm in his head that he could possibly use that as an actual deliberate finish later on, where you try to split the crowd. My one other little note is there are two guys who are hanging around here way later than you'd expect, Greg Valentine and Rick Martel, and they stay in the Rumble a lot longer than one would think in 1994. I think they both get, like, what, 20 minutes plus?
I think historically they've always had good runs in the Rumble. I know they've had 30, 40 minute runs each of them in the past, so it might be tied into that storyline that they're good Royal Rumble workers.
Martel's like the original Iron Man, basically, isn't he? Like the
Valentine had been gone for a while. He had just showed up for this match.
Yeah, and that's why he just kind of stands out as somebody who his face doesn't seem to fit in the scene there in early 94. No, I don't really have a lot of thoughts. I mean, this is just a Rumble. I don't think it's. JT. You know, I know you were there, but.
Always be special to me.
In the pantheon of Rumbles, it's not one of the absolute worst, but it's also not in the top tier either. That would be my take.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I think it's in the middle. What I did like, though, they tied in a lot of long-running feuds and had guys either show up and eliminate each other or battle. Like, you had Crush and Savage go at it, and Crush and the heels, you know, eliminate Macho Man. You have Bigelow throws out Doink. They had been feuding. And even you even get Sean and Marty tussling when they come out. They go, like, they do the crazy lock up and punches when Marty comes in. So you kind of have some nice tie-ins to long-standing feuds. Even Tataka, Bigelow throws him out. And then the DiBiase line I wanted to reference is, so Adam Bomb comes out at 30, and he only lasts like under 5 minutes, and he gets thrown out, and DiBiase just shreds him. If you haven't heard this in a while, Parv, you should go back and listen to it. He's like, what an embarrassment to be a guy that big and coming that late and not last much longer than under, you know. He just lays into him, like, really lambastes him out of nowhere for, like, being this giant embarrassment to, like, be a massive guy his size and lose in under 5 minutes in the Rumble. Coming in that late was awesome. He just buries him. And then the finish is the finish. I mean, you know, it's been hammered home a million times. So it was a great night, though. The crowd was pumped. It was a really cool atmosphere. It was a Saturday night, which was really cool. I'll always remember fondly. And you can check out PlaySimNation.com, my first of many plugs here tonight. me and Josh Richer did an ode to our friendship and this show, We Missed the 90s. So if you look under the We Missed the 90s tab, we did a long-running thing, kind of our friendship, how it tied into the build to the Rumble and us going there live that night. So check it out. And there's some shots of our homemade Backyard Wrestling Federation in there as well. So enjoy.
Well, that was a very thorough answer to our first question there. Alan, what else have we got in the sack this week?
All right, swiftly moving along, we've got two different listener questions here. We're going to tie into one. So the first one is, Dear Alan and Parv and JT, I would like to ask for you two guys, or you three guys, to discuss the rise and fall of Ludwig Borger. And that's from Rogue Wren on Twitter. That's a friend of the show. And also we've got, Dear Alan and Parv, my favorite wrestler is, and always will be, Ludwig Borger. What can you tell me about this great Finnish superstar? And that's from Chadley Crisolo in Norwich, Connecticut.
Awesome.
So, hello, Chadley. Hello, Ren. Thank you for the questions. So, the Hellraiser from Helsinki, personal favorite of mine back in the day. I enjoyed him. I don't know about you two. To me, he used arrogance and he cut a good promo. I liked his reckless brawling style. And his theme music was just the Finnish national anthem, which kind of make him stood out a little bit compared to other competitors at the time. So just starting with you, JT, have you got any kind of memories of old Ludwig?
Yeah, I was a Borger fan. He had a cool look. He was unique. And, you know, when you're 12 at the time when he debuted, you don't really know that Finland's not this like national power. You kind of just know that they're there. So to me, it was like, wow, this guy's really pissed off about America and, you know, doesn't like the pollution. He's upset about it. It was a weird take looking back that they had this monster heel debut by, you know, trashing the country, but doing it in a way that he's ripping on the filth that's around. But
yeah, it was the environmental laws and the educational system that he took exception to.
It was very odd. But it was, you know, it was a fine feud with Luger. I thought he did a good job. I liked his, you know, the accent was strong. Like I said, he had a good look. I'm not sure I enjoyed the capri pants. Like, I thought if they had him in regular tights or like full, you know, legged pants, he might have been a little more serious looking. But I felt like the capri pants with the tank top was an odd choice. But he was he was fine. I was sad when he left, like I mentioned earlier. I thought his run was not nearly as long as it should have been. And they really booked him well. He killed guys in squashes. And I thought they did a good job. Him ending Tatanka's streak was like a big deal. And they did that really well, too. Yeah, it was a good run for Ludwig that should have been much longer than it was.
Well, he actually broke into the business. It was an interesting story. He kind of made his name in New Japan. But he was actually in the country at the time in Japan because he was the bodyguard for the band Cheap Trick, American band. And that's why someone must have seen him. So what happened, he had some previous work as well. He had worked in Southern California for Herb Abrams. As Tony the Viking Helm. So he had worked for the UWF previously. I don't know if that was for a TV spot or what. But I think with someone like Borger, he had a good look. He was, you know, quite convincing with his style. And I think they put him over really huge at first because I think he beat Marty Jannetty at SummerSlam, didn't he? And that was, Marty Jannetty had been a former Intercontinental Champion earlier in the year. So him to beat him so convincingly was quite a big statement, I felt. I mean, for you, Parv, did you buy into Borger as a heel?
Well, I've actually spent most of the morning watching Ludwig Borger videos, and I mean, I didn't really remember that much. I mean, I remember him being around, but watching him again this time, I was like, well, hold on, these packages he's doing on the State of America, like he's walking around these, you know, abandoned factories and things, you know, talking about the death of industry, and you know, that one line I thought was really profound was, the places the Lex Express didn't stop. And I just thought, oh, wow. and it actually has a bit of resonance with recent political events. You know, it reminded me of the Rust Belt, you know, Detroit, places that haven't been doing so well. I actually thought it was a really interesting take. So that was good. And then I was also impressed by his work. I mean, I watched him absolutely destroy Virgil in one match. But I also watched a match that you sent me, Alan, against Scott Steiner. And I thought, this was actually pretty good, you know. There's also a bit of a tie-in to another show that I do here called Where the Big Boys Play, where we actually reviewed a match that he had in New Japan against Ron Simmons. The match was nothing. But that led me to discover his kind of... what he did after he was a wrestler as a politician. You want to touch on that, Alan?
Well, he was a politician, he was an actor, and he was a bit of a weird politician from the kind of research I've done. He made some odd comments about the Prime Minister when he was a politician. He called her a lesbian, even though she wasn't, and that was quite offensive to her and other people that he did that. And yeah, he was kind of someone that was had a few personal demons as well, unfortunately. But someone, you know, for I think he passed away when he was 40, in his 40s. So he had a very interesting life up until that point, as we touched on. He'd been a wrestler, a bodyguard, he'd wrestled a New Japan Tag Team Champion, an actor, a politician, and a UFC fighter as well, Parv. I don't know if that came up on your research, because he was at UFC 13.
I watched a random match he had in 98, I think, with lots of blood. Have you seen that?
Is that he had a match, he worked for Rings as well, so it may have been Rings that you watched. I mean, the match that he had, or the fight that he had, was against Randy Couture at UFC 13. So he's done plenty of different varied things, and he's an interesting kind of character in the world of wrestling. I mean, the reason he kind of left was he injured his ankle in a match with Rick Steiner, cancelling the WWF really to have any future plans for him, including a scheduled appearance at the Royal Rumble, which we've touched on, and then a proposed match against Earthquake at WrestleMania, which we've touched on as well at previous show, and it was Adam Bomb that took that slot. So,
Adam Bomb. he loses again really quickly. Ted DiBiase was onto something. I kind of wish Borga called Scott Steiner a lesbian now during that, before that match, because that would have been really funny. That match was really good. It was on Raw. They beat the shit out of each other. It was that was a really fun kind of, unlike a match you see during that stretch in WWF where they just kind of unloaded some bombs on each other. It was pretty good.
And I felt that Borga had a better torture rat than Lex Luger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just before we finish up on him then, go on there, JT.
I'm sorry?
Sorry, were you going to say something?
Oh, no, I was going to say his torture rack was more fueled with hate. So Luger's was fueled with Americana, but Borga had the Borga had the hatred of a whole country behind him from Finland, unleashing of that rack.
Well, following his unfortunate death, Jim Ross had a few comments about him. So what Jim Ross said was, I won't speak at length about those that have passed away, but Tony obviously had issues and was not a great guy to be around. Perhaps others have a different view of this man, but I personally found him to be somewhat obnoxious, and he could be a bully if allowed to be such. Guys like Holm don't mix in any locker room and need to be removed from the team sooner rather than later. I feel badly about the last years of Tony's life as things really unraveled for him due to drug and alcohol abuse. So some comments there from Jim Ross. I can see, you know, he wouldn't be someone backstage that really would do well. He seemed a bit of a loner, a bit of full of himself. That he was this tough man, you know, from his bodyguard days, and you know, he's foray into MMA later on. So he kind of fancied himself as a tough man, and I think that wouldn't have gone well, you know, down in the locker room around that time period.
I honestly think he'd get over today, Ludwig Borga, if he was around, because of that MMA
style.
Is he better than
Rusev?
Well, I need to clear up these comments, because it's been. I was just having a little chat with my good friend Chad Campbell, and I just said I think his character work is better than anyone on the current roster apart from maybe Jericho and Charlotte. And he brought up Rusev, and I said I think his character work is better than Rusev's, and this has led to him declaring Twitter war on me. so there we go. I mean, you guys watch the current thing. I mean, I Rusev is good, and I'd say he's probably a better worker, but. Is he as good as a pro? Like, has he ever done anything as good promo wise as some of these Borga things I was watching today?
Go on, JT. Sorry,
it's a tough comparison because, you know, we can't see Borga in this environment of social media, and you can kind of be yourself. You could be goofier. Like, Borga had to stick to this character of being from Finland and being mad about pollution. I mean, that's all he had. Like, you know, I want to see Rusev if he could have gotten that over as well as Borga did back in 93. So, I mean, it's tough to compare. You know, it's like Borga was within these tight constraints of how the company was presenting their characters, whereas Rusev can go out there and make fun of people on Twitter and come out and be a goof. And, like, you can't, you know, and he does. He's great. Rusev is great. I'm just saying he's got a little more leeway. He's like a quarterback that plays in a more, you know, looser defensive era versus back in the day when the defenses could beat the shit out of everyone. So
I feel like if Borga's hadn't had that injury, he'd be probably a bit more fondly remembered than he is. He feels a little bit underrated to me in the overall scheme of, because I was actually a bit surprised just by how good he was compared to some of these other people we've looked at in the past, Alan. I mean, you know, he's clearly a cut above your Fantasios and Battle Cats and Bastion Buggers.
And people of that ilk. I mean, I enjoyed him, like I touched on at the start. And his run was only 6 months, so people really didn't fully kind of invest in him as a character. If we'd seen him, you know, be pushed a little bit more as a heel, he may have, you know, done something in a Royal Rumble. He most likely would have beaten Earthquake at WrestleMania rather than bloody win the title like Scott Keith had alluded to. but yeah, I mean, that's Borger in a nutshell. So I hope we've answered the question for Chadley. And Chadley, so now Borger's your favourite wrestler. We may have to... Yeah, we may need to stop you here, Chadley, and you have to decide on someone. So
you might have peaked here with Borger.
Yeah, we may have done, and we kind of agree that with Chadley that he wasn't that bad. Where everyone else that Chadley loves, we kind of don't love. So that's quite interesting. So shall I go on to the third question?
Alan, can I get one more plug in here? Because if you want to read the true story of Ludwig Borger's 1993 run, PlayStation.com, Filth, Pollution, and Corruption, The Ballad of Ludwig Borger, talks all about his run and where he is today, because I don't believe those news stories. I have the real take on what he's doing right now. So check that out if you're into Ludwig Borger and fan fiction.
Alan, it's like doing a show with a permanent plug, you know, with a permanent ad running under it, you know.
I'd rather have these plugs than 50 cent shave clubs and everything else that they're done elsewhere, you know, and... Yeah. Boxer shorts and underwear and all that crap. Anyway, so on to the third question of the day. Dear Alan and Parv, can you elaborate on the Berserker? Is Colosseum Battle Royal Victory, the swords, etc.? And that's from PSI, and he's on Twitter. So I love the Berserker. Everyone considers him a Bruiser Brody ripoff, but I think there's a bit more to him than that, guys. Well, I'll start with you on this one, Parv. What are your takes on the old Berserker?
I split my morning between watching videos of Borger and Berserker, and I watched his debut as the Viking, he had a real commitment to that character. I'll just say that the hus, the holding out of the hand, which we can discuss in a second. I love the gimmick of going for the count out victory, which is just hilarious to me. I watched him, there's some really funny stuff that he gets up to. You sent me that video, Alan, of how to party with him and Mr. Fuji.
I need to cover that in a minute.
And so, which is definitely we need to talk about. Generally, I'm of the mind that the Berserker is one of the all-time great kind of gimmicks that gets kind of celebrated as wrestle crap. And I actually think it was good. Really solid mid-card or... maybe lower mid-card gimmick. I like the Berserker. JT?
Yeah, I liked the bottom too. I mean, like you said, he really was committed. I mean, I think it was him. I think he just came over from Iceland, and it's a nice tie-in to Borga, right? Scandinavian. But yeah, he comes over from Iceland, and he's brought in as the Viking with Mr. Fuji, who's always trying to find these unique, rare cases, and he didn't hold back. I mean, eventually, like you say, you know, he carried that sword, and he tried to stab the Undertaker, and I thought they kind of hung him out to dry. Survivor Series 91, he's on this team of awful, awful people, and he ends up looking the best. He makes this to the end, but they get swept clean, and then he sets the sights on Undertaker in 92, but I agree. I thought he really bought in. It was believable. I love that split he used to do where he'd get hit and he'd do the full split when he sold. And he had a good finisher, just chuck the guy to the floor. And that always made him an instant threat in Rumbles and Battle Royals because his finisher was the way to win those matches.
Yeah, I mean, he had a few AWA TV appearances. Not a few. He did work in the AWA before this. He was quite famous up there because there's a video of him selling cars. I don't know if you've seen that, selling secondhand used cars. It's on YouTube, guys. I don't know. Have either of you seen that?
No, I haven't.
I don't think so, yeah.
Oh, man, it's amazing. We'll have to link this on the show. You really need to watch this. He slams someone into a car bonnet, and it's just really wacky. So you should check that out, you guys and the listeners. With the Berserker, he did something on Coliseum Home Video, how to throw a party. So it's simple three-step process, according to the Berserker, how to throw a party. So the first one is the invitations. So the Berserker shows us the best way to get a guest is not to use invitation at all, really, but to go and find someone backstage at a WWF event, put them on your shoulder, demand that they come into the party with you, and then walk off saying "hus hus." So that's basically how the Berserker gets people to his parties. So that was step one. Step two is the entertainment, and what the Berserker recommends is gimmicks and stuff. his own words. And what those gimmicks and stuff were those noisemaker things that you have at parties. And sadly, everyone's favourite Scandinavian grappler is unable to make it work, so he just eats it instead. So, you know those party things, Parv, that blow out? Those party poppers, those things you pull.
The ones you blow, we know the ones.
Yeah, anyway. So that was step two, was the entertainment. And he feels that eating these things is a form of entertainment. So step three was the food. So using his mighty sword to lop off the peanut butter, our hero then shoves his fingers into the jar and spreads the nutty goo onto the bread. See, he's using his fingers to make sandwiches. Just these are, because he's using his fingers, he makes the pun that these are finger sandwiches. Get it? And the berserker at this point finally figures out how to use his blow his noisemaker, much to Mr. Fuji's delight. So that was a great little segment where we know these Colosseum video segments we've touched on before. That was one of the favourite ones that we didn't touch on previously. Is there anything else that you guys stand out for you in his career in the WWF?
Well, I mean, we have to talk about the Jameson thing, Alan, because that was incredible.
Oh my God, it was. It was brilliant. Have you seen this, JT?
Not a long time, but I remember it, yes.
So what he's doing, Parv, is he takes JT out the studio, doesn't he? It's the Primetime Wrestling Studio, the one with...
He takes Jameson rather than JT.
Yeah, he takes Jameson out the studio. It was the old Primetime set, the one where they'd force the employees to come and stand there, sit there behind... normally it was Vince in his special tracksuit and Bobby Heenan. So what they did, he tied him up, put him on a stake, so to speak, put him on his shoulder, and the kind of payoff was he threw Jameson off the top of Titan Towers. So what we see is Jameson careering through the air, and then we just pan back to the studio where we just see Vince McMahon in disgust and shock at the actions
ridiculous.
Of Berserker.
I mean, I remember watching Raw in, what was it, 98, when Austin, was it? Rock throws Austin off a bridge or something ridiculous like that. Do you remember?
Oh, no,
that?
It's the belt. No, he throws the belt off the bridge. But no, the ridiculous one you might remember and get mixed up is when Hogan threw the giant off Cobo Hall.
Oh, yeah, that was it. Yeah.
No, somebody did get thrown in the water, though. You're right, Paul.
I seem to remember.
Austin. Somebody, it was someone.
Somebody got thrown. I want to say it was Austin got thrown off a bridge. Yeah. But at some point in those crazy days of the Monday Night Wars, that happened. But this was even more shocking because he really, like... It just looks like he would die, really, if he was thrown off the roof like that.
Well, especially Titan Towers, it's about 30 floors up.
So, yeah, that is really worth watching if you haven't seen it. The other one, did you watch this one, JT? The very odd match against the Barbarian, a rare heel versus heel match that took place. Did you watch that?
Yes, I did. And, you know, it's weird because I was wondering if, like, they were testing the waters with a Barbarian face run because he's kind of in the face role in that match. He gets a beating for a while, and then he goes after Mr. Fuji, kind of makes a fiery comeback. And then if you remember, too, in the 92 Rumble, Barbarian comes in, he goes after Flair. That's the whole, you know, back and forth between Gorilla and Bobby. So I wonder if they were testing the waters a little bit for a Barbarian face run. But it was a pretty cool match. I thought they matched up well. They were both the same size, kind of same style, hard hitting. They looked like a good pair. I would have liked...
Similar gimmick.
You had the old, you know, the Barbarian and the Viking. Like, it was kind of cool. I think they should have teamed them up. I think after the match, they should have, like, looked at each other and shook hands. Like, that they should have fought to a double count out and then realized they were better together than they are
apart.
Yeah,
kindred spirits. But, yeah, he worked as Nord the Barbarian, didn't he, in the AWA as well?
He did. Just one interesting thing is that after years of Mr. Fuji misguiding his career, Barbarian finally gets his own back on Fuji and breaks his cane over his own head. So that
he
was,
almost like knocked himself out the first time.
That was something to see. So I was actually wondering because when did that match happen? 92, tail end of 91. Is that the end for the cane? Is that why Fuji goes to the robe and the bald? You know, because Barbarian
he gets a replacement because I know he has one at 92 Rumble because they he hooks it in the corner and Owen Hart gets slung into it. So I think he has it for at least another year or so, but it's not the same. It's not his original cane.
No, it's cane number two. Like, you have Lucille number two, the trombone now, don't we, with the New Day. So
when Jake got the second snake after Earthquake killed Damien, it wasn't the same, but it was still there.
Yeah, so the Berserker just finishing up on him. One thing that was touched on the question was the kind of the swords angle that he did with The Undertaker, where he attempted to stab him, and The Undertaker just rolled out the way at the last split second. That was quite a different change of pace as an angle, because it was treated as kind of attempted murder in a way, wasn't it?
Yes, it sure was. And I remember being surprised that they didn't have them fight at SummerSlam that year, because that happened over the summer. And I know a lot of times feuds didn't make it all the way to SummerSlam, but they bring in Kamala, who to me was a much inferior worker at this point. And Berserker was well established in the company. Kamala had been gone for, you know, 5 or 6 years, as far as in the, you know, the fan base had turned over quite a bit since he was last on. So you kind of have Berserker established. He tried to murder The Undertaker. Why don't you just roll with that at SummerSlam?
No, I think it was mentioned in the question as well. He had a Battle Royal victory on a Coliseum Home videotape. I don't remember that. Do either of you two remember seeing that at any point?
It doesn't ring any bells with me. JT?
No, I don't think so. Maybe, I feel like a tag match or something here or there, but I don't remember anything.
I remember his prowess being talked up at the Royal Rumble, that he was good at throwing people over the top rope. But I don't remember him actually winning a Battle Royal. So,
he did actually. Now I'm thinking about it. He did, and I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. I think he won a 40-man on primetime.
Oh, well, there we go. Because that was just his skill. His finish was throwing people over the top.
They had a couple of those 40-man battle royals. I think he won one of them.
Just before we finish up here, guys, there are two things I want to mention about Berserker. One is that I really do want to try to get each of your takes on what's that thing with the hand he does? Because Monsoon's take is that he was actually begging for money, that he was actually asking for a handout. What do you think he does with that? You know, he says hus hus and then he puts his hand forward. What's that meant to mean? JT, any ideas?
Well, I mean, you know, in 1992, you know, it's a combination of factors. We had a few things. 1992, the America went into a recession coming off of 90-91. So I think, you know, there was a bit of would have been struggling a bit. Also, the company was kind of on a downturn, not paying as well. He's got to give the cut to Mr. Fuji. So, I mean, how much you get taxes? Like, how much do you think he was actually bringing in at that point? It could have been much. Maybe, you know, 25-30% of his paycheck of what he expected. So he maybe just kind of, you know, conditioned, maybe Fuji kind of mind warped him into going out there and begging for money all the time.
No, I think that's a good takeaway there, JT. I'm going to go with that one.
The only other thing I wanted to mention real quick, and this is going to lose me, you know, Larry Matisic and Sam Muchnick and so on, if you're listening, apologies, but for me, people say he's a Brody ripoff, and you know, I know he may have even kind of trained under Brody at one point, Alan, is that right?
Yeah, they had a mentor-pupil relationship on TV a few times together in the AWA.
But for my money, Berserker's a better worker than Brody. I mean, Brody's Berserker's just better. He's more agile. He sells. He does better moves. I've seen a lot of Brody matches, and only a handful of them are any good. And one of them is against Dory Funk Jr. So.
You're not getting a Hall of Fame vote now from Dave Meltzer for that comment.
don't you guys think that Brody's like ridiculously overrated and Berserker's actually way more entertaining and better?
I would say Brody is overrated in the grand scheme of things, but I still think he's had some fantastic brawls, you know, lots of different places. I mean, he's a one-trick pony to a degree, so I can see why people do feel he's vastly overrated. I do feel he is overrated to a degree. I still enjoy him. I enjoy the Berserker. I like both of them. I'm allowed to like both. So that's why I'm going with that take, Parv.
All right.
July 6th, 1992, primetime. He won a 40-man battle royal, Berserker.
There we go. Well, I might have to see that. That sounds interesting. Okay.
I did. Yeah, there you go.
Well, it's time now, I think, to go over to JT Rodero in the Event Center.
Let's take you down to the Event Center.
Hey! Hey, guys.
So, how do you want to do this? JT, take it away. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm just going to talk, and you guys can talk too. I will be able to interactive. But I wanted to go back in time to 1993 because it's a pretty important date. I believe it was November 18th, rather. Vince McMahon indicted officially by the federal government for trafficking of steroids and distribution of steroids, usually the steroids. So faced 3 count of steroid-related charges in Long Island, New York. Of course, it would eventually go to trial in 1994. And I'm not going to get into all the gory details here of the trial, but it was a scary time for Vince. And he had all kinds of things and, you know, everything prepared in case he went up the river, up to the clink in the Hooskow. And he had Jerry Jarrett come in late 93, begin to prepare to take over the creative side of things if he went to jail. He brings Jim Ross back to handle color play-by-play commentary duties in his place. He brings in, sets up Linda McMahon as CEO of the company. So he's really starting the process of assuming he's going to be in jail. And he had everything lined up. And, you know, the story that you always hear is that from jail, he'd be there kind of calling the shots and communicating with Jerry Jarrett to run the creative. But that, for all intents and purposes, Jarrett would be in charge of the, you know, non-business end of the company, the booking of the arenas and all that stuff, where, you know, the storylines, the angles, the matches, all that would go through Jarrett. And of course, where Jerry goes, so does Jeff. So we see Jeff debut in the fall of 93 as well. It was an interesting time. Do you guys remember any of this as it was going on, or is this all like revisionist for you?
No, for me, I do remember at the time. It was covered quite well by Power Slam magazine in the UK. No, its forerunner, actually, at the time would have been Superstars of Wrestling, which, JT, you've probably never seen that magazine, but it was non-kayfabe magazine to 90% of it. Covered Japanese wrestling, got people in the UK here into All Japan, into New Japan, into FMW, pictures of them all, into ECW. They covered most of the arena shows with great photos by George Tahinas in there. So we were quite lucky. We got a decent magazine compared to your PWIs and things that you guys are inflicted with. So there were some pictures at the time of him entering, going into court. And if you remember at the time, he had the neck brace. He had neck surgery at the time. And I don't know if that was to get some sympathy from the jury or what they were needed it. I'm not too sure. But the other quick point to make is where you mentioned Jerry Jarrett, there's one person that's refuted that claim quite recently on a podcast, and that's Brother Love, Bruce Pritchard. He's basically said that's not true. Jerry Jarrett wasn't brought in for that reason. Totally disagrees with it. It would have been run by the office. He didn't stipulate who would have taken over. He said it was basically no one. We would have managed without him, and we would have gone and seen him ourselves. So it would have been Patterson and him he was alluding to, really. And Jerry Jarrett, he doesn't rate him at all. He thinks he's a rubbish booker. He thinks he's a rubbish promoter. He's got no faith in him at all. He really buries him. Much to, I mean, Jim Cornette gets involved because he's got appearance on Jim Cornette's podcast, but he totally refutes that claim. So that's quite an interesting one. There's people who say he did 100%, and there's someone else that was there at the time who said he didn't. So I'm not 100% sure now anymore if it was Jarrett or not.
I mean, they obviously brought him in. So even if he wasn't going to have full control of the book and everything else, he was clearly brought in to be like a steadying presence, a veteran mind to help out while Vince was gone. I mean, there's got to be a reason they brought him in at that time beyond just kind of having that relationship with Memphis. I think there's some truth to it. You know, maybe Pritchard wasn't fully, you know, given the details on what was going to happen. Maybe Jarrett was kind of just in the back pocket. But I think there's a reason he was brought in. And I think part of it was that Vince may be going away.
One of the things I'll say is that my impression is that even though Vince basically did destroy all of the territories and so on, my impression is that behind the scenes, the promoters were always like reasonably within a phone call away from each other at any given time. Mm-hmm. So my impression is that over the years, he may have picked up the phone to Jerry Jarrett or even to Vern or even to Bill Watts at various different times. Not just at this time, but like, say, like randomly, I don't know, in 1989, it wouldn't be inconceivable for Vince to ring any of those guys. So, yeah, I don't see it as being that weird. That's just my thought. And I do think you have to take old Brother Love with a pinch of salt for obvious reasons, because his takes on things have been interesting, to say the least, on that show. So in the interest of time, shall we get to the long question, chaps? We could easily spend like 4 hours on the steroid trial, but
let's do it.
I think it's been done, hasn't it? So let's go to the long question.
Right, go back into the sack for the long question. So we're combining two questions again here. So the first one is, dear Alan and Parv and JT, you mentioned a few weeks ago that you would return to the topic of the early Raws from 1993, can you? And that's from Jason Weber in Fall River, Massachusetts. So thank you for the question. And the second one is, dear Alan and Parv, can you discuss WWF production in 1994? They started turning down the lights for everyone's entrances, and they were using buildings for Raw where you could actually see the walls. I hated it so much back then. And that's from a fan of the show, Dean Coles, 1987, on Pro Wrestling Only. So thank you for the questions, guys. So it was an interesting time period around this time, and it is indeed true they were running smaller buildings, and there's a reason for that. There's a downturn in business. That's evident from the kind of figures we've got on the average attendances for house shows and things. So they were fit. For me, it was a logical step to go. Oh, you're not going to run big buildings when you're not getting big crowds. So you're going to run small buildings. So it made sense from a business point of view, but aesthetically, it looked really weird for me. So JT, for you, when did you first become a fan of WWF, and was it pre this, and then did this look weird to you as well?
Yeah, I started watching like right before WrestleMania 6. So seeing the downturn of buildings was weird, but I think part of me just rationalized it away that they liked the because like they go to the Manhattan Center for Raw, and it's like, okay, so maybe they're just going for more of this homey feeling, you know, where they want to be more intimate and closer to the fans. I think at the time, I just didn't, I don't know, I just don't think I was paying attention at that level beyond just saying, oh, okay, this is just what they're doing. Like, I don't think I thought, oh, wrestling's not as big anymore, because to me, it never really changed. I wasn't watching during Rocket Wrestling when everyone was talking about it. The same people that talked about it in 1990 to me were the same I talked to in 1993. So it never felt like a downturn in popularity for me as a fan. But the other thing, if you notice too, a lot of the buildings they were running, especially Raw, they really hunkered down. It almost became more regional again. Like, they really rarely left the Northeast for a bit there. They would still venture out maybe for a big Superstars taping here and there, but especially for Raw, they were just, they'd go as far as like Virginia, you know, here and there, but a lot of it was New York, Pennsylvania, you know, Connecticut, and like that was it. They didn't really veer off too much.
Yeah, but that's always been my. They run the Manhattan Center a huge amount as well, don't they? For the Raws, for the Raw tapings.
But not as many as you would think when you look back at it. But yeah. But
the interesting thing about the Manhattan Center is it's got two ballrooms in it: the Grand Ballroom and the Hammerstein Ballroom. I'm led to believe. Obviously, I'm not from New York. I've not been there. But Raw ran in the Grand Ballroom, and that was a smaller one of the two. The Hammerstein Ballroom is much larger and is configured differently. So it's quite interesting. Out the two choices they had for places within that one building, they actually chose the smaller one out of the two.
It must have been cheaper.
My take on the kind of booking during this period, the kind of I guess this, when Vince was in steroid trial mode here in 93 and 94, right, is that taking a long view, I see a real return to WWF funded, like hunkering down, like you said, JT, a kind of return almost to the Vince Sr. territory, where, you know, yeah, they will run occasional big shows outside of that, but they're really returning back to that old school loop, you know, with the MSG, the Boston. You get that quite a lot during this period. And also, the way they booked Brett during this time, I've always thought is a return to the way that they used to book Backlund back in the day. So, any thoughts on that? The kind of, you know, return into the core territory, as it were?
Well, yeah, in the past, we know that they ran the Agricultural Hall in Allentown, PA for TV. They ran Hamburg at the Fieldhouse. They ran the Mid-Hudson Civic Center in Poughkeepsie. And they're all small kind of places that held around about 1,000 people. And they were the size of high school gyms, but they weren't high school gyms as such, but they were the same similar size. I mean, the WWF, they ran high school gyms around this period. I know that the low points for them in terms of attendance and aesthetically would have been the Monday Night Raw tapings that were held in a high school gym in Liberty, New York. And that was December the 13th, 1994. And that was 1,400 people. It was a sellout. And there was a tiny crowd for a Raw looking at it now. And they did also have another high school taping, and that was in 1995. That was at Struthers in Ohio, and that was 1,450, and that was a sellout as well. But they're tiny, really, buildings, aren't they? I mean, ECW, if just around the same time, we're getting around 1,200 into, I mean, ECW arena shows at least. So it was quite interesting that they were running such small places. So anything you want to kind of touch on about this, JT?
Yeah, I mean, there was one real barn they ran for Raw, and that was the Alexandria Bay Castle Recreation Center. If you look, I mean, it literally looks like it's a shed. And it looked like it was 100 degrees. Doink wrestled, and his paint was melted off his face within like 10 seconds. Everyone was soaking wet with sweat. it was pretty a crazy atmosphere. It was very, very odd show, and that's where they had the Macho Midget surprise debut was on that episode. And another place they ran quite frequently toward the end of the year was the Fernwood Resort in Bushkill, Pennsylvania, another very tiny arena. And if you look at some of these, is one of them where Crush and Macho Man are brawling backstage, and it looks like it's just like an office building. Like, there's like this weird green carpeting and like, you know, wood paneling, like fake wood paneling, and they're fighting near a desk. It's just really, really odd. But yeah, they definitely hunkered down. They were cutting costs, you could tell, and they were trying to do what they could to bring that more regional flavor. And like you said, Barb, I agree with the way they were booking Brett. And you know, even for a bit when they had Yoko on top as a dominant heel champ, they just kind of had him battle all comers as just, you know, a steadying force on top of the main event scene. Those early Raws were interesting, though. They definitely were. There was a lot going on. They had, you know, they happening, and then they had weeks where there was huge things that happened, and you could tell looking back that it was more around kind of sweeps time-ish, you know, May and September, November, and things would happen. And the other thing I always found interesting too, they'd have these storylines that existed only in the Raw universe. So like Duggan and Shawn Michaels had this, you know, 2-week feud that existed solely on Raw, and you'd have these through lines on episodes of Raw that didn't ever carry over to anywhere else. It was like its own universe for a while, and that by the fall that kind of fades away, but for its initial run it felt very much removed in many ways from the rest of canon that was going on at the time.
I mean, this is an interesting thing because Raw basically replaces prime time, doesn't it? But the A show had always been Superstars, and there's an interesting period here in 93 where it's not clear, like, how would you, if you had to rank the shows at this time, JT, what's your A show, what's your B show, and so on and so forth? Because to me, it's not always clear what the main show is when you go back to, say, I don't know, April 93, say, for example.
I think Superstars is the main show through 94. Like, that was still where they made the big announcements. That was still where a lot of the title changes happened that were announced matches. Like, yeah, we had the Shawn and Marty thing on Raw, but other than that, they rarely did too many title changes. I guess Steiner's Quebecers was another one, but Raw seemed almost, you know, it wasn't far off from the primetime template as far as, like, they'd have that one showcase match. A lot of it was contained within the show. I think throughout 93, for sure, Raw was not the A show when it came to main storylines. Now, they presented it like an A show because it was live and they had big time matches and the atmosphere. But when you look at the actual progression of, like, storylines and build of pay-per-views, the big stuff still happened on Superstars. That was where they wanted the most people to see it because more people had syndication than they did cable.
Well, I would definitely agree with that, especially over here in the UK, because we didn't actually get Raw in any kind of form until, I would like to say, 1995, you know, on Sky over here.
Sounds right.
We had it in clip shows. You saw clips of stuff on WWF Mania and these kind of other kind of clip shows of what's going on that week in WWF. But it was always pushed over here that the main show was Superstars because, for whatever reason, WWF and Sky couldn't come to an agreement on airing Raw. So there was another interesting thing I noted before we kind of wrap up this topic is there was a Raw I watched from April 1993, and I sent this over to you, Parv. I don't know if you remember watching it. The two takeaways, firstly, was the interesting conversation between Money Inc. and the Beverly Brothers. Did you see that, Parv?
I did watch that. That was really psychologically in-depth, wasn't it?
It was about how to avoid wrestling, how to wrestle the Steiners and what moves to avoid and things like that. So it was quite interesting. But the thing after that was IRS came out to the ring, and it was with the setup at the time, which was the kind of neon lights going across the entranceway, but they just weren't working. They just weren't on, and this was in a live Raw. I mean, one of them was on. It was kind of flashing, like, just sort of, but the rest just weren't working. It was, had they not paid the electricity bill, and things got, you know, that tough at that time period. I'm not too sure, but it really stood out to me as something that didn't kind of fit the glitz and the kind of smooth, slick presentation that we came to see from the WWF.
Speaking of Money Inc., there is one other thing. I've just remembered this. A few weeks ago, I started watching some 93 Raws just to, you know, remind myself. And I ended up seeing something, a little wrinkle in the WrestleMania 9 match build to, what was it, the Mega Maniacs versus Money Inc. at WrestleMania 9. Now, I watched WrestleMania 9 a lot as a kid, and, you know, Sean Mooney had that all-time great countdown show, which is arguably better than the pay-per-view itself, where he presents this whole story. And this whole first chapter of the Beefcake comeback is completely cut off from it. And I didn't know it happened until I watched this stuff. So if you haven't seen it, I can't remember exactly which episodes they are, but they're definitely worth watching because Beefcake comes back. And basically, I mean,
is this where he's a loser?
Oh, he's a loser.
I mean, JT, do you want to explain exactly what happens here with Beefcake's comeback? Because I really do think it's one of these hidden things that isn't really recorded in the way WrestleMania 9 is remembered.
Yeah, they don't bring it up much, I think, because it was kind of embarrassing. So, I mean, I was a big Beefcake fan when I started watching in 1990. And when he got hurt and went away, I was sad. And then he came back into the barbershop, and I never really expected him to get in the ring again. So then we get this weird announcement on a Superstars that Brutus Beefcake is coming back, and he'll be on Raw this week. So I'm like, oh, this is awesome. So Beefcake comes back, and he gets interviewed by Vince McMahon. And I think this is maybe when they started to realize Raw shouldn't be the A show because of the live crowd. So he cuts this long promo, and, you know, they're in an environment now where they can't can it. They can't cover over the reactions, and the New York fans are just brutal. So Beefcake says, you know, he got injured, and then his wife left him, and his dog died, and his mother died, like all this stuff. Just
his wife
brutal.
Just doesn't leave him. She leaves him for, like, he's literally cuckolded. He is a complete loser. Like,
and I like to think it was like Mr. Perfect or something took his wife to his ultimate payback for WrestleMania 6. You know, just one last knife in the back. So yeah, this is really down on his luck loser. He's all holed up in a hospital bed, and then some kid from the crowd, you can hear it loudly on audio, "Kill yourself," he yells. And it's just like the atmosphere is unreal, and it's going quickly down the toilet until they kind of hint, you know, and he basically says, "There's only one man that was there for me, and that was Hulk Hogan." And so then he says he wants to get back in the ring, and then we get, you know, Money Inc. comes out, and we get this ham-fisted Jimmy Hart face turn where he all of a sudden feels remorse because he doesn't want Money Inc. to kill Beefcake, basically, with his repaired face. And so they have the match the next week, and they have DiBiase and IRS attack him after the bout and bust his face up with the briefcase, and then Hogan shows up a week later. And that's when the official build for Mania kicks up. But yeah, that stuff is all dusted over pretty much.
There are a few things to mention about the, I mean, he doesn't just say that Hogan came back. He is really, I mean, he says the red and yellow stood over me, and it's almost like he almost like compares him to God. It's so weird. So there's this image of like Beefcake down on his luck on his knees with Hogan standing over him as this kind of angel figure. It's so strange that whole, I mean, it's not just, it's homoerotic and like religious at the same time. And Money Inc.'s angle is weird as well. Like, a few things happen that you wouldn't, like, first of all, DiBiase has no reason at all to get involved with this. He's basically a loser and he wants to kick him when he's down. So just, unmotivated evil. And then Money Inc. have a coin toss for who ends up facing him on the Raw, which is another thing that you just...
Right.
And I watched that thinking, did that happen? They had a coin toss on live TV to see who would face Beefcake. So he just put that... Because I've always thought that the IRS Beefcake slam on his face, you know, was, you know, with the briefcase. I've always thought that was one of the greatest moments ever. And this,
he really decks him with it too.
And this put it in a whole new light, like knowing the backstory and stuff. So, that's definitely worth seeking out from the early Raws. Anything else, guys?
One quick comment just on the 94 part of the question. I think, too, they made a very clear shift around WrestleMania 10 when they wanted to focus on the new generation. And finally, you know, I think they made it a point at 10 to... All right, we're finally done with Hulk Hogan. We're moving on. This is the group of guys we're going to go with. We're not lingering in the past anymore. And then they start that whole campaign, you know, out with the old, in with the new. King of the Ring is very much like that. The new generation, Bret Hart and Diesel and Shawn Michaels and all these guys.
And Nikolai Volkoff.
Nikolai Volkoff, featured heel player. But I think a lot of it, too, you could see they wanted to make it feel more attractive to newer young fans. Like, there's neon lights everywhere, light shows. They dim the lights and have... you know, specialized lighting for everyone, where 123 Kid, they'd have the 123 numbers, and DiBiase had the money sign spinning in the ring, and they seem to really try and make the more of a concert atmosphere for kids when you're there live, like more light show, more in your face, like everyone has music now, so it's more, they were definitely trying to engage kids, I think, more at this point with the whole new generation mentality.
And there's a point where it feels like it goes like luminous green on top of all of that. I want to say like the Godwins, when do they turn up? Like, so it gets into that horrible, probably more in like 95, where you get like the luminous, like it's all dark, but you also get those horrible kind of luminous colors all over the place as well. Sparky plug with and
Todd Pettingale.
Pettingale. Oh, it's just a horrible period. Yes. So I think that'll do for this week's show. We do have the WWF magazine corner, but we've gone very long tonight, chaps, and I feel that in the interest of time, maybe we should return to the magazine corner next time. So if people want to get hold of you, JT, how can they do that? If they want to, you know, suggest topics for the event center or tell you how great Place to Be Nation is, how can they do that?
talking on mute. Everyone can tell me how great Place to Be Nation is. I never get tired of that. You can follow me on Twitter at Place to Be Nation. That's Place. Let me make sure I get it right. I think it's Place to Be Nation spelled out as the actual name, but it's at Place Number Two Be Nation. So you can follow me there on Facebook. You can hit up the Place to Be Nation Facebook page as well. That's I answer the messages there, and we have a live chat page as well where we have a lot of ongoing commentary and conversations throughout the day. Of course, we got forced there when Facebook kind of overhauled the group pages. So if you want part of that, just let me know and I can add you in. ProWrestlingOnly.com on there as well, Bigelow34. So you can follow me in any of those areas and we can chat.
And Alan, if people want to write into the mailbag, how are they going to do that?
They can send us a message. We started a tweet where people can add to, can search. If you just search on Twitter for Letters from Kayfabe, you'll come across it. It'll be one of the top ones. So add your questions there. You can follow me on @Alan_Cheapshot. And something else I want to quickly plug is my YouTube playlists. I've not really mentioned them on the show, really. I've probably made about 200 custom YouTube playlists with lots of different playlists, such as the best matches from 1991, 92, 93, with all the footage you can get around the world. Introducing kind of certain wrestlers, remembering certain wrestlers that have passed away. So lots of kind of footage people kind of deep dive into, and lots of world of sports stuff that people might not have seen as well. And you can check that out at tinyurl.com/playlistwrestling. And that will take you to the YouTube page with all the playlists. So you can check that out as well. So how can we get you, Parv?
I'm on at Jerry Von K. And the one thing I will mention really quickly is that when this show goes out, there will be just over 2 weeks left to get your submissions in for the PWO pilot feed, pilot season that we're doing. That is, if you have a unique wrestling show that you would really like to exist that doesn't already exist, record a show, try to make it around an hour. So we're trying to lead by example here, but it's difficult, I know. We've started playing some pilots already. The first one went out just this past week. It was Stacey and Elliot. They did a great show on. Did you listen to that, Alan, on the Charlotte Sasha Banks Hell in a Cell match?
Not yet, but I want to, because I don't rate that match as highly as many people. So it's something I did comment on the thread that it's something I'm going to check out the weekend after we record this. So definitely check out the pilot shows. There's some exciting other shows going to come up on that over the next few weeks.
Yeah, but apart from that, thank you very much, JT, for coming on for the whole hour.
And had a blast.
Join us next time on Letters from Kayfabe.
Check out my pilot show, Under the Sheets.
But I just came out here to give you a little bit of background and to let you know just exactly how and why I arrived at this decision. Let me tell you, let me just start it out. Let me lay it out for you like this.
Please do.
Just before the accident, after a lengthy bout with cancer, I lay my frail 85-pound mother in the grave. Yeah. Okay. And not shortly after, I lay my father, who died of a heart attack, half from grief, half from sorrow, right next to her.
This is all prior to the accident.
This is before the accident. And then when things were pretty bad, Vince, and I was down, and I reached out for my wife, she slapped me upside the head with divorce papers and took off with some barfly with everything I had.
All of this is prior to the accident. Nobody knew that.
Well, you know something, Vince? Notwithstanding all this, and I was pretty down at this point and a pretty desperate man and broke and desperate, as I was walking along the beach and looking up into the sun, baboo! The knees of a girl parasailing smashed me in the face and shattered my skull in a million pieces. You know, my eyes were squashed into the back of my head, but my ears were still working. And as I was whisked off in the helicopter to the trauma center, I heard them talking. I heard what they said. And there wasn't much of a chance for me at this point. The next thing I knew, I was in the hospital, surrounded by doctors. And once again, I was listening. They weren't giving me much of a chance. I was laying there without so much as an aspirin for 24 hours, waiting for him to decide what to do with me.
What was going on in your mind?
Vince, I was beaten down. I was about to give up. I felt the life blood oozing from my body. I was reaching out with my hands. I was putting myself in God's hands. When another hand reached out and grabbed me. That hand was none other than the hand of Hulk Hogan.
He's always been your friend to the end, Brutus.
Always. Not more than that, Vince McMahon. Hulk was right there as I came out of surgery with my eyes sewn shut, a steel bolt through my nose holding my forehead on, my jaws wired shut with steel, 8 steel plates, 30 screws, 500 stitches later, Hulkster was there as they pulled the bandages. And as I saw a glimpse of light through the big, fat, swelled up eyes, the first thing that I saw was the red and yellow standing over me. And he was saying, "Don't give up, Brutus. You got to fight because me and all the Hulkamaniacs are behind you all the way. And no matter what happens, you'll be taken care of." Well, from that point on, from my first step to my time I left the hospital to the time that I was back to my feet and regaining my strength, the Hulk was there all the time.